Thank you for coming. I'm writing a book, and I want to talk with you about the unwritten, unthought-through last chapter of the book. So this is, it's not quite a sketch, because a sketch is too well-formed, but it's something close to that. The book's called Everything is Miscellaneous. And by the way, there are a couple people here who last week helped me by listening to a version of this, a much longer version of this, at Fellows Hour. So thank you very much. And this will be shorter and much more focused. So the book is called Everything is Miscellaneous. In some sense, it's coming along. You know, I think I just finished the seventh chapter out of nine. But this is misleading, because finished only means finished getting written, and then my editor sees it, and it's up to my editor to decide if the chapter is done, or if she says, you know, there's lots of good stuff in here, and sends me back to rewrite it. So in some sense, this is where I am. The other reason this is misleading is that especially chapter 9 is supposed to be about the effect of what the other eight chapters have said, the effect on knowledge. And I don't know what that effect is. I'm facing a deadline of July in order to make up my mind and figure out and have a position, which is a hugely artificial constraint, which I accepted gladly because I took the book contract happily. Nevertheless, to think that in July I have to have an opinion on this seems to me to be just plain weird. Nevertheless, that's what Chapter 9 is going to have to do. So very briefly, this is what the book is about. The idea is that we've organized ideas and knowledge using the same principles of organization that we've used for organizing laundry and our kitchens and physical stuff. But now we're digitizing it so we can invent new principles, and these new principles affect the principles of organization affect the nature and authority of knowledge. So hence Chapter 9. So I want to very quickly go through seven properties of traditional knowledge, just so that, well, for two reasons, which you'll see. The main one is just to be clear about what I mean by knowledge. So these are, I think, seven basic properties of the Western tradition of knowledge, and I am talking only within that tradition. So the first is that there are three terms in the relationship: the knower, what's known, and knowledge. For Aristotle and the Greeks, knowledge is a way in which the world and the mind meet. It mediates between the two. In fact, the original sense of information came from the Aristotelian sense of the world informing the potential that is the mind. And over the course of time, over the course of our history, we've moved the location of knowledge further into our own head, so it's no longer between us. It becomes a representation. A pretty deadly idea, by the way, but that's where we are. Nevertheless, three terms: knowledge, knower, and known. Second property is that knowledge is the same for everyone, just as the real world is. Closely related, there's one knowledge. If there are two people who disagree over some bit of knowledge, at least one of them has to be wrong, because there's only one. One way is right. Knowledge is simple, not to say that it's simple-minded, but it's simpler than the world that it explains. The reason we need knowledge is that the world isn't exactly the way it looks. It looks like a blooming confusion, and then over the course of time we figure out what principles work, what is stable in it, how to explain it. And those principles are simpler than the world looks. So it's in some sense, knowledge is a simplification of what is, in fact, complex and chaotic. Because of this, we have needed people, we've needed experts in order to help us filter, because the fact is that most things aren't knowledge. If you look at all the things that people believe, and this is, in fact, right at the very origins of knowledge in our culture, in Athens, the problem exactly was that people would stand up and make statements and try to persuade you one way or the other, but there were more statements made, more opinions held, than there was truth. And so you needed a way to figure out which opinions to believe. So most things aren't knowledge. Knowledge is a relatively rare commodity in the tradition, and thus we need experts to help us identify it. Next is that because there's one knowledge, the same for everyone, it doesn't matter who says it in our tradition. The same thing is true in anybody's mouth. Same thing is false in anybody's mouth. And so the what you see happening is, in fact, the abstraction of knowledge from the sort of human living political context that gave birth to it. So by the time we get to the sense that knowledge is independent of the knower, that it doesn't matter who says it, that it's stripped of voice, that in fact it should be uttered in our tradition in this voiceless, impersonal tone that still characterizes, for example, the rhetoric of professional journalism and the sound of the professional newsreaders. Knowledge, by the time we get here, knowledge has been so abstracted from the living stuff, from what matters, that it's become, well, at least very abstract. Next is that knowledge is bigger than we are. That is, and this Francis Mixa at the University of Texas puts this well, I think, and the idea is that we think of knowledge as being a transgenerational realm, that if we work hard and make a good contribution, we maybe can get something put into that garden of knowledge that exists apart from us and will continue after we die. It's not a coincidence that description of knowledge as something transgenerational and apart, and if you work hard, you can put something into it, is also precisely a description of the physical library. The relation of knowledge and the objects of knowledge, books and libraries, is crucial. And finally, this is the seventh one, knowledge is orderly. Your knowledge is not just an accumulation of facts. The organization of knowledge is itself knowledge. So, for example, this is one very common one. In fact, I'm going to claim this as a prototype of what knowledge looks like. We like knowledge that's been arranged into trees, hierarchical trees, which pack a huge amount of information into them implicitly, so that simply by knowing that something is a robin and thus is a bird, we also know, without having to think about it, that it's a vertebrate, that it's an animal, that it's a living thing, that it's made of atoms, and thus we can apply all the rules of physics to it. There's a world of knowledge that is kept implicit in a tree until the moment you need it. So it's a very efficient way of organizing knowledge. And we've liked them a lot. One of the reasons that we've liked them a lot is, besides their efficiency and their orderliness, the fact that this is also the type of map we use for power relationships for businesses, for example, or in the military, is entirely the opposite of coincidental. So if you take at least most of those seven, it turns out that they are properties not only of knowledge, but also properties of the real world, which is not a coincidence. It's because knowledge is knowledge of the world, and so you would expect the content to be the same. You'd expect the content to be the same. But these are formal properties. And knowledge has these properties not so much because the real world has these properties directly, but because the objects that we use to represent knowledge, to communicate it, and to preserve it are physical objects, and thus are subject to those laws. So, for example, for books in particular. With books, if you want to write something in a book, have it published in a book. If you have some complex order the order is knowledge as well. In other words, if you want to show how all the animals are related, you're going to have a lot of difficulty doing that in three dimensions, because paper is two-dimensional, is in essence two-dimensional. So our techniques for diagramming are limited by the two-dimensional nature of paper. And the fact that our information is published in books means, for example, that we have to decide what single major category to shelve a book under. What is that book about? And we allow multiple references and see alsos. Nevertheless, we have to put it in one spot on one shelf, which means we have to treat it as if it's an object in a tree. You can't put it in more than one shelf at a time. Which is one of the characteristics of the hierarchical trees that we've used for knowledge is, in fact, that a leaf can only be on one branch, cannot be on multiple branches. Also because of the economics of the physical world, imposed by the physical world, there's a limited number of books that can be published. just too expensive. There's a maximum length to books. Encyclopedia Britannica is 32 volumes and 65,000 topics, not because there are only 65,000 topics in the world, as Wikipedia has abundantly shown, is not the case, since they've topped the million already at Wikipedia in English. It's because it's too expensive to produce many more than 32 volumes, and at some point it becomes too hard to look things up. It takes up too much shelf in the library. I mean, physical objects are just a pain in the ass. So the and if you with those types of limitations on publishing, then clearly you also get the regime of filtering of what of experts who are made experts by the fact that they are the ones who are allowed to publish, and from that comes a different type of economy of power. So physical objects have determined to a large degree and have constrained the ways in which we organize knowledge. This traditional view of knowledge is under siege. It's hardly a new line of attack, a new set of attacks. It's been attacked by relativists who morally cannot tell the difference between Hitler and Mother Teresa, and in terms of knowledge cannot tell a true fact from a false fact. It's been attacked by postmodernists on, I think, some very important grounds. It's been attacked by philosophers from Wittgenstein to Rorty and a whole slew up and down and before and after. And it's been attacked by, by Eleanor Roche, whose work was written up and made a little more popular, and in some ways I think less accessible, but that's by George Lakoff in Women, Fire, and Dangerous Things. And I'm happy to talk about what she says when I'm done, but really briefly, because I think it's very important. But really briefly, Roche is a cognitive psychologist at, I think that's not actually what she terms herself. Anyway, she's at UC Berkeley. And she discovered and then proved empirically that, in fact, we do not organize our world around us in terms of Aristotelian categories and neat trees, with each of the categories well-defined by a perfect definition that cuts with a knife, the knife's edge, through the confusion of the world and determines which things are birds and which things are mollusks. But instead, we work through prototypes of objects that we don't have definitions, we have examples, and the examples are good examples or bad examples, which is a very messy sort of relationship. We organize our world that way, that a robin is a really good example of a bird. A penguin is still a bird, but it's not such a great example. It's sort of like a bird, but in some ways it's more like a, and so forth. So rather than having a neat Aristotelian framework for our thought, we have a very messy one with multiple clusters and leaves on many, many branches, and leaves more on one branch and less on another, but still on a branch. Much, much messier view of the world, which I think is captures much more about what it means to how we think. Plus, as I mentioned, there's empirical evidence for this as well. But since I'm fact challenged, I can't help you with that. So it seems to me the strongest challenge by far to this traditional view is coming from the fact that we're digitizing information, which means that we no longer have the limitations of the physical. And thus, I think that we are moving from... I'm going to get to the topic in just a second. I have a particular topic I want to raise with you within this. So it seems to me that we're moving from a view of knowledge that thinks of real knowledge, the best cases of knowledge, you know, the prototype of knowledge, to be, if you can organize things into a tree, then you've really nailed it. And in so doing, you become an expert, or you rely on experts, and this tree then is to guide others. And the value of the tree, to a large extent, is the fact that it excludes so much. You know, most things are not knowledge. So you need an expert in this world where we know so much. We need experts to help us keep us from all the bad information, the non-knowledge that's competing for our attention. So that's the traditional view, and I think because of the digitization of information, we're actually moving to a different view that pulls the leaves off of the trees, makes a giant pile that's richly embedded with metadata, each of those leaves. That you can think of that pile, by the way, as being the web, or the internet, although it's actually much broader. It works, I think, within networks that are detached from the internet and a superset of the internet. Nevertheless, you know, just think about, as an example of this, the most important example of this, the most important instance is the internet. So each of the nodes has enough metadata that we can find it. And this flips the old way of being an authority. So the old way, I'll take that back in a minute. The old way is that you become an expert and you thus keep us from bad knowledge. You filter on the way in so that the collection of stuff on your tree is all good knowledge you can rely on. Clearly there are benefits to doing that. In this model, in the leaf pile of leaf model, the miscellaneous model, where everything becomes miscellaneous, hence the title, the value becomes in including as much as you can, excluding stuff, even for the best of reasons, even excluding stuff that's pernicious, stupid, and dangerous, or any combination, and offensive, any combination of those, excludes stuff that maybe at some point somebody's going to want to find, for whatever reason. Maybe they're doing research on the stupid, offensive, and dangerous. Maybe it's 50 years from now. So excluding becomes a negative value. Being as inclusive as possible builds value in the collection, in the pile. And the second thing that changes is that rather than having to filter on the way in because of the power of computers, users can filter on the way out. They can organize, select and organize things as they want to in ways that make sense to them at that moment given that project and that set of beliefs and cultural stance. So this, of course, raises issues because we have this big pile. The question is, how are we going to pull it together? And one of the ways is, is algorithmically. And there's been lots of interesting stuff done and lots more that will be done. This is Flickr, the photo site, as you know. Flickr has started automatically clustering. They have over 100 million photos. They've started, which are tagged by individuals who anybody who looks at them can provide a tag, pretty much. So, how do you make sense of this enormous pile of photos? Well, with enough of that, a big enough sample, and over 100 million is an awfully big sample, Flickr is able to use purely word-based algorithms to cluster. So, this is the cluster of noses. So when you search on noses, it will say, do you want to see some clusters? We'll show you all the noses, everything tagged noses, or you can look at clusters. So we have figured out what some of the clusters are, says Flickr, simply by looking at the other tags associated with it and doing some statistical analysis. So here are the cat noses, and here are the dog noses. And it gets it pretty much right. Flickr's clustering is remarkably good. It's not perfect, but it is remarkably good. And one of the questions, of course, is it's remarkably good but not perfect. Well, if you're designing a system for air traffic control, it better be perfect, not remarkably good. If you're looking for pictures of cat noses, it's not so bad if a dog nose sneaks in. If you're trying to find pictures of San Francisco because you're going to go visiting there next week, it's not so bad if you accidentally, it includes some pictures of London, Ontario. Or if it doesn't include some pictures of London that have been tagged as pub or something. It's not so bad. So the degree of accuracy, precision, recall that's required is task-dependent. Another way of, in this miscellaneous world, one of the important ways that people are figuring out to give users control, enable them to navigate in ways that make sense to them, is through faceted classification, such as at the North Carolina State University Library, where it's tough to do a slideshow demo, so I'm just take my word for it when I say that from the user's point of view, what you can do in a faceted classification system like this one is you can start sorting the books into groups based upon your way of thinking about them. So rather than having in a normal tree, the owners of the information would decide, you know what, the most important way of browsing is by century. So we will organize our books first by 21st century, 20th, and so forth. And then we'll let our users browse. Once they've decided on the century, we'll let them decide by topic. Or maybe go the other, that's just an example. Maybe there's a different way of doing the tree. Nevertheless, in a traditional tree, the owner decides how the branching works. In a faceted system, a user can come in and say, you know what's most important to me? I want to browse by country of author's origin. And once I've done that, then I want to browse by century, or vice versa. So users get to construct trees dynamically as they browse. And this gives control over the organization to the users, while still presenting them with a tree-like structure. It takes some heavy computing to do this well. But now we have heavy computers, so we can. This is another example of the clustering. This one is at Flickr. This one is, if you search on Capri, it says, do you want to see the island Capri or the cars Capri? Or the apparently there's a Capri motel in San Francisco that's gotten more than a few photos. I don't know why. Or neon signs that say Capri. Again, sort of interesting why there are enough of those. Nevertheless, those are the clusters that the system has algorithmically determined. Then, of course, there's tagging, about which I will say nothing, unless somebody wants me to. You know what tagging is? Delicious. There's tagging also at... but tagging is very important. I'm not slighting it. I'm slighting it just not to be incredibly boring.
I have a quick question on it.
Yes.
When you use the word tagging, you have a very specific meaning for it. But other things you talked about sound like tagging. So is there another word you use for the more general term tagging?
No.
What about labeling?
Well, the Flickr is still tags.
Okay.
It's tagging photos, not URLs, as it Delicious. But it's basically the same in that a viewer or user can apply a word or two as a label to enable her to find the stuff again. And all those tag objects and the tags themselves are available socially and publicly, so you can see how sort of the drift of crowds, which is called a folksonomy. So this is even Amazon is tagging now, although they've really done nothing that I know of to let users find the taggings buried in their on their page. This is the Grapes of Wrath, and if you want to, you can tag it. You can see that one of the tags is books, which seems to be a relatively low value tag. Although if enough people tagged all the books, you would then have the top level of a hierarchy that you could easily. Easily reconstruct from the tags. So I'm back to thinking about my writing problem, which is the writing of Chapter 9. And one of the obvious ways to write it would be to go through the seven properties of knowledge. And I may well do that and show how they've changed. That seems to me a plausible way to organize it. I only want to very quickly talk about a few of these because I want to raise what I think is a larger point. So, for example... knowledge simplifies. Well, it seems to me that we're really interested in complexifying things now. That the interest in blogs is an interest in taking what looks simple, pulling it apart, seeing how it works, turning it inside out to see if it's funnier that way, arguing with somebody else who reduced it to something too simple or got the complexification wrong. The blogosphere is this mighty realm of complexification and rejoicing. Reveling in complexification. Because we've had simplification from marketing and from government and to some degree from education for a long time, and it gets a little wearing. Also, for example, we're going from an environment in which the news is filtered for us and weighted for us so that we get a front page, a static front page, the same for everyone, that tells us here's the most important thing. Those decisions are made by editors, who have reached the pinnacle of the journalistic career and highly expert in what they do. Nevertheless, inevitably, it's only their point of view. It's one we should respect and listen to. Nevertheless, it's only one. Right now, there are lots and lots of sites springing up that enable readers to decide what they think is the most important news of the day, to do that together, to do it increasingly, and I think this is the most important development in the near future, to do that, not just everybody at the same site gets to create one front page for that site, as at Dig, for example. That stuff's great. Nevertheless, it's even greater when we'll be able to filter news through people, particular social groups and networks. So we are all, I'm going to guess in this room, We all read the paper through the web anyway at this point. That we're getting referred here and there by blogs and email and mailing lists and sites like Dig and Slashdot to stuff we would never have found in the news, and are having small stories that seem small to the mainstream media, be pointed out and recommended to us by the Internet. The Internet's been doing that ever since email, and it will continue to do so in more ways. Knowledge has been impersonal, doesn't matter who says it, but the most, in many ways, in many households and ours, the most trusted journalist is Jon Stewart, who's a comedian, who gets his authority precisely through his voice, through his individuality. One and the same? Well, there's obviously a huge postmodern question here and lots of ways to go wrong. And all I want to say is the following. That when it's a hot day and you go into a bar and you ask for a beer and you drink it and it's good, but it's not the perfect beer, you do not slam it down on the table and on the bar and say indignantly, "This is less than perfect." Go out and go to the next bar, take a sip of that one, slam it down and say, "It's not perfect either," and thus never ever get a drink. What you do is you drink it and you say, "Oh, that's really good. That's pretty good beer. Oh, that is pretty good beer. May not be the perfect beer, but it's good enough." And good enough is becoming the measure for most of our informational requirements, which means that in some sense, not in the deep postmodern sense, but in some sense, what is knowledge for each of us is what's good enough for me may not be good enough for you, and so we have multiple knowledges. Aircraft controllers, surgeons, not happy with good enough. And should, you know, we don't want them to be happy with good enough, so this is domain specific, nevertheless. Okay, so here's the thing that I want to talk with you about. We have this big pile of leaves. We just did it to ourselves. You know, we made some number of billions of pages, and we're continuing to. So we have this huge pile of leaves. It's getting bigger and bigger at a speed we can't even calculate. And that is a formula for disaster, except because it's fragments. It's just a big pile of leaves. You know, that's not the. Except that this metaphor is misleading. I like it because of its connection to trees. Nevertheless, there's a misleading element to it. The misleading part is that a big pile of leaves, no leaf is connected to any other leaf, except by proximity, whereas on the web, through tagging and through lots and lots and lots of other things, including hyperlinks, which are the most important ways in which items are related, leaves are connected. This is not like, it's not like a library, for example, where the books do get clustered by topic, but otherwise have no other relationship among them. I mean, they have footnotes and references, but that's a huge pain in the neck. You want to track down a footnote, you go to the Harvard Library, and you know you're going to be there all afternoon. You're going to be going up and down through a maze trying to find and hope that the one copy isn't out. You know, tracking down footnotes. So, yes, there is a referential environment in books, but it as if you wanted to make it as difficult as possible to follow those references. Oh, yeah, well, that's great. We'll have a system of references. In order to make sure that nobody can actually find them, we will move the books apart into almost random spots. So the pile of leaves, the digital pile of leaves, hugely important that we remember that it is insanely connected. The number of connections is beyond imagining. So this brings me to the following. This is Martin Heidegger around the time that he wrote Being and Time, which I think was 1927. I keep meaning to look it up. Might be 29. And if I were online now, I would know. In which he says, as his prototype object is a hammer, that to be a hammer, to know what a hammer is, to understand it, you have to know a whole bunch of things. You have to know what nails are. To understand what a hammer is in our culture, I mean, if it's on Mars, maybe it's a hammer or something else, but to know what a hammer is, in a very simple sense, in the sense in which you pick it up and you can use it, you have to know about nails. And know about nails is know about wood and the properties of wood, and you can drive nails into it. And know about wood, you really have to know about lumber yards, which means you know about trees, which means you know about forests, which means you know about the economy that connects the lumber yard and the forest. It means you know about the sun and the earth on which forests grow. And everything else. You have to know about everything else. So this is to say that meaning what something is depends upon its context. This is what makes it intelligible. But both those terms seem a little cognitive to me and a little bloodless. So I like better, as does Heidegger, the term meaning. That this is what, in a simple sense, this is what it is to understand the meaning of something, and that this referential context of the wood and the nails and the forest and everything else is meaning. It is the structure of meaning, the infrastructure of meaning, which allows individual things to be intelligible, to have their meaning. But this infrastructure is unspoken. You can't possibly, every time you say, have you seen my hammer, you can't also say, you know, the thing for hammering nails, it goes into wood, that uses lumber yard. You cannot do that. All of that has to be implicit. It's the only way that it works. But if it's implicit, what's implicit is not simply sitting there the same as the explicit, but you just haven't said it yet or you haven't shown a light on it. It has a different character. So, which I guess I'll come back to in a second. So, we have this habit, humans, of externalizing the functions of consciousness. So, books, in some obvious senses, externalize knowledge, externalize memory. Writing externalizes memory. And calculators, to the dismay of elementary school teachers, externalize arithmetic. And you know, what's his name? Andrew Clark has a book called Being There. He's both in the computer science and philosophy departments at, I think, University of Pittsburgh. But everything I've just said that was factual undoubtedly is wrong. Nevertheless, so he's sort of cross-appointed in this book, Being There, I really, really like it. It's about the fact that thinking is done externally in the world through books, through if you're a physicist and you're writing on a whiteboard, you cannot do your work without the whiteboard. You can't think unless you're, you know, generally, if you're a physicist, a mathematician, you need the whiteboard to think, and that thinking thus is externalized. So we do have this habit, I think he's absolutely right, of externalizing functions of consciousness. And what I'm thinking of saying in Chapter 9 is something that I like the sound of but don't really understand, which is that this connected miscellaneous pile externalizes meaning, that we are now in the process of externalizing meaning, this referential context, this implicit and that's the difficulty. So I want to talk for a couple of minutes about explicitness, and then I'll be done, and the implicit. This is a jar of jam. The photo was taken, perhaps, I don't know, I stole it off of Google, at a roadside stand, let's say in Vermont. I just made that up, but we're going to go with it, okay? And it has a label. The label says strawberry. This is very different than the photo of that same jar that gets posted to Flickr, where it gets tagged, let's say, with a bunch of stuff. Those tags are never going to amount to what we know simply from seeing the actual jar at the actual stand. The actual jar at the actual stand is embedded. Because the difference between what we know and what we tag is, in fact, the world. Right? It's the entire world. The real jar is embedded in a real world and has all of the meaning associated with it, everything that we know, whereas the bits on the page at Flickr, all that we know are what some random people happen to have tagged. So we can't explicitly build up the same level of implicit knowledge that we have in the real world. And that's an issue. These are my two of our kids. You can tell from looking at them a whole bunch of stuff that's implicit there. I can tell you some things about them if you ask me about them. And actually, it'll become much easier much easier if you ask me in the course of a conversation in which we're talking about health or education or something specific. And then, you know, I'll tell you what I know about my kids, insofar as it makes sense, but I cannot make explicit everything I know about my children. And if I could, it would be a sign that there's something deeply wrong with the relationship. The relationship lives necessarily in what I know implicitly, and I cannot make it all explicit. And that's a problem if, in fact, we are externalizing meaning, because we can only externalize it in the digital world by making things explicit, like tagging the jam. we go wrong all the time in this regard. So this is a photo of a gas pump in Alston, right up, you know, the edge of Boston, where that label that says start is actually the button you press. It's a very badly designed interface. It's a little rubberized. It's not raised at all. And nobody could figure out to press the start button. So the gas station put in a label to make it clear to people. So the point is not that we are bad at metadata, because we're fantastic at metadata. We learn to read metadata before we learn to read. The point is that we have a real issue when the implicit becomes explicit and the explicit becomes implicit. When those levels are not really clear to us, we can go terribly wrong. Well, that is an issue. It seems to me that it will become more and more of an issue. It seems to me that we've spent a lot of time over the past 10 years talking fruitfully about the change in the line drawn between the private and the public, and it's a conversation that continues, and as it should. I think we need to spend an equal amount of time talking about the line between the implicit and the explicit, which isn't just shifting back and forth, but we don't even know what dimension to begin talking about. It's extremely different and difficult to talk about the implicit because, guess what, you're making it explicit. So, but something is going on in our culture. There's a changing relationship between the implicit and the explicit that we need to pay attention to, and that has a direct bearing on knowledge and on meaning, because meaning is the accumulation of the implicit. So we are going to, nobody here needs an argument about this. It seems to me that we are going to continue adding to this pile of leads, drawing more connections. And we're going to do it through tagging. And, tagging may turn out to be a relatively small part of it. I mean, right now, it's a tiny percentage of the world actually does tagging. But that's far from the only way that we'll do it. I mean, we do it by creating trees as experts or as amateurs who organize stuff and maybe make those trees available. We'll continue doing that. Trees have tremendous value. We'll do it through the semantic web that likes to find triplets of relationships. And that'll work in some places. Some places it'll just be a bad idea, but it'll work in some places. We'll do it through text, through web logs and the rest of it, through hyperlinks that not only draw connections between leads but contextualize them, explain why we think it's an important link or the nature of the link. We'll do it through playlists, not just for records but also for syllabi and for books. Yes, an H2O plug. Playlists are a really interesting and important way of organizing information for ourselves and to share. So we'll do that more and more. We'll do it through building our own front pages using the software that exists now and software that we'll invent. In fact, it seems to me that this is basically the task for the next 100 years. This is what we're going to be doing. We're going to be pulling together all the stuff, all the digital bits that we know and care about in new ways. We're going to find new ways to do that. So it doesn't seem to me that knowledge is dead, long-lived knowledge. It doesn't seem to me that that's what's going on. It seems to me that instead knowledge has more or less, it's fallen in love, that the context out of which knowledge grows has always been this messy, implicit realm. We are working now. We're always going to continue working on knowledge. For all the obvious reasons, it's really important that we know what we know and that our sciences advance and that our policies become based more on knowledge and less on stupidity. So knowledge does not need, in this sense, does not need a champion. And we're going to, knowledge, we're going to keep doing it. We have the institution set up for doing it. But meanwhile, we've seen this enormous upsurge in meaning and building an infrastructure of meaning by pulling together pieces for ourselves and for others in loose and in tight ways, in ways that make sense now and don't make sense later. And every time we do that, we enhance the value. We increase the meaning of the world that we're building. Okay, so that's where I think Chapter 9 is headed. And it would be really good for you to knock it down now before I'm ridiculed in a larger public.
Is Chapter 9 the last chapter?
Yes. Yes, Chapter 9 is the last chapter. Rebecca. Yes.
There was an article in the New York Times, I think it was, just the other day, sort of blaming Google for making kids less able to use libraries, making an argument along those lines. I don't know if you saw the article.
I didn't, but I think it was the New York Times.
Because I read everything on the internet, I forget where I read it.
Is that the Sunday article? Is it Sunday?
Probably, yeah. I can't keep track of the days either. But that all being said, basically, the point being is that because kids are so used to using these tools like Google to go and search for information, they don't know how to use card catalogs. They don't know how to go look for information in this.
The abacus is dead too.
Traditionally structured way. And so, my question for you is: are they lamenting the wrong thing because information no longer needs to be structured in the ways that libraries structure it? Or, I mean, you haven't read the article, so.
Doesn't keep me from having a strong opinion about it, Rebecca.
Strong opinion. Or maybe, I know we have some other librarians in the room, and so there might also be other views on that.
The new head of the ALA, he's not so new anymore, but wrote that, boy, he's really on the warpath against all this digital stuff, which is distressing to many librarians, on my note. And one of his points, many of his points were good, and one of them was that Google decontextualizes, that it's really important to read a book all the way through, and taking the snippet out that you found in Google keeps you from getting not only the whole story, but being trained in how to follow an argument. And there's a lot to that. I mean, that's the question isn't, though, are we going to do that or not? The question is, well, we're doing that. Now what? It's not like we can make a choice about Google or libraries. That's done. One of the questions is, how do we need to change the way we teach our children so that the virtues that are bestowed simply by the inconvenience of paper don't get lost in the shuffle, so to speak? There's absolutely a problem of decontextualization, but there's also a different sort of contextualization that's happening, which everybody on the web, who's seriously on the web, knows about, namely the thing you just said, which is you can't remember where you read it, and the reason why you can't remember where you read it is not because your mind is weak.
Well, that too, of course.
It's because in doing so, you read another 50 things that you started there, and you hopped off there, and you hopped off there. So you got contextualized in a different way.
Right.
One that does not help one make long-form arguments. You know, not you in particular. Sorry.
I was wondering if you've been consulting with linguists in this research, because it seems to me that the questions about what's implicit and explicit are similar to what goes on in the formation of languages, and the whole question of hierarchies. Different languages have different ways of categorizing information. I don't speak German, but I understand it's much more structured than your average language. So I was thinking that could be helpful too.
Yes, and this also shows up in the taxonomists who are taxonomizing basically language. That's pretty much what, because their taxonomies are built out of language. I'm aware there's a lot of debate over how structured language is, and whether that's a reflection of brain structure or cultural structure. So.
And it might be interesting. There might be people at MIT, maybe someone in here knows, but because MIT is so strong in linguistics, but also in computing, so the people who work with the linguistics of computing may have thought about a lot of these issues. Does anyone know?
If you do, let me know.
Related to that, this time through, I saw the first version of this, and actually this is really clear, and this is a great presentation. I really don't have any criticisms, but something that came up in my mind this time through was this effort at MIT called Common Sense Computing, which is at the Media Lab, which you probably know of.
So the open source version of the Doug Lennett AI project. I want to make sure I'm talking about the same thing.
I don't know too much about it. I just know the basic
concept.
They have
anybody who wants to, because it's open source, can contribute small knowledge about how the world works. That asphalt gets hot. Asphalt can get too hot to walk on barefoot because you want the computer to be able to have common sense. We know not to walk on asphalt coming across the, on a summer's day coming from the beach. The computer doesn't, so it needs to be told all this stuff, and this is an effort to get all that stuff in there, which is the great making explicit of everything.
I don't have a real clear question there, but is that in the same spirit of what you're talking about?
I'm so skeptical about that project. I have a really bad reason not to talk about it in this book. I talked about the Lennett version of it, which is basically the same thing, a private one, in my previous book. And so I have like this stupid reason that I want to stay away from it, even though I think that it is actually a... it is one of the great examples of the belief in the ability to make everything explicit, which I don't believe in. So... within particular domains.
I have a question. Where is the limit?
Between of what?
Of making everything explicit. When do we hit that limit of making the implicit explicit? Or how do we know we're at that limit?
It's again, domain specific. So when you go to Friendster and you have to type in your profile, things I'm interested in, if that works... Especially if there are conventions around what sorts of things. You read other people's and you see what sorts of things they list. For example, at Friendster, which is basically, started out anyway, is a dating site. The president of Friendster conferences, the tchotchke he would throw out were condoms. So let's just skip the euphemisms about getting laid. So if you look at the profiles for various Friendster people, and I haven't, but let's say... sex. What are you interested in? Do you list sex or not? I mean, that's a sort of a social norm that will grow up there. How many items do you list? Do people list 100? Do they list 10? If there are social norms and those turn out to be useful for people to find each other and go dating or whatever, that's great. Then explicitness is working. If your aim was to try to discover what people are interested in by asking them, having them write it down, I believe that you'll fail in that case. It's because we can't do that. We're interested in things hook us, right? Their interests are not just internal. So depending on the domain, you may be able to go all the way with explicitness. To think, as in the case of common sense, I can't remember, the Lennett thing, the name of which I still forget, that you will be able to make all of the world explicit. Seems to me not reasonable. However, maybe you can make everything we need to know about petroleum exports explicit, and now you can have a computer system that is able to scan newspapers and say sensible things to you about it. So, I'm sorry, it's a complex answer, but that's part of what I mean by figuring out where the line is between the implicit and the explicit, where we're moving it to.
That makes sense to me if I only think about text, like communicating by word.
Yeah.
But as things move, I don't know how you would make the implicit explicit.
Suppose you had software that could make a guess, let's say pretty good guess, about the mood of the people in the photo. Does that seem impossible to you?
No.
It seems plausible to me. Yeah. Be correct a useful amount of time. It means that would be something. Mm-hmm. But it wouldn't be able... It would be a long time before it could figure out that the picture of the five guys on the beach are in fact parodying the scene at Iwo Jima. Which we would get right away.
But the communication would be that, for example, in the case of the software, the communication to you about people's moods, well, it might be a little graphic, like these people seem happy, but there would still be a text component. So I'm just wondering, as the internet develops, as people begin communicating with one another using these different mediums, like video or like photo, that unless, in order to make things explicit, you have to have the text to
In order to extract the text from it, extract the explicit, does it have to be extracted into language?
Yeah.
That's a really good question. I mean, presumably you could, if you did the happy photo parsing, you could say, find more photos like this one, and it would pick up on the mood and skip the language, exposing you to the language. But maybe you're not making explicit then what the character is. So I don't.
An example might be something like an image porn filter, where it's doing no language, but it's just looking at, you know, how much pink there is in a picture or whatever, and figuring out this is porn and tagging it with all the other porn in the world. But that's there's a number there, right? That's all that's being messed around. It's the porn number.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not even sure whether that counts as explicit or, I mean, not the picture, but, you know, what's going on is explicit or implicit.
That kind of raises the question also of whether you're defining knowledge as human-centric or something beyond human. Because you can say that, you know, machines are developing a different body of knowledge than our traditional set. Or you could say, you know, anything that can experience anything, like a bird has a different way of conceiving of air than we do.
So then we need to further define knowledge.
Right.
So I think we want to exclude knowledge from birds. And that's just a conventional thing.
Right. But then I think more and more...
Although we do say they know their way home.
But we're relying more on machines to develop tagging systems and to, you know, screen for pornography. And that's not necessarily rooted in the text that would be human.
Does the view that we shouldn't make everything explicit also mean that the large amount of data that is implicit going to remain hidden essentially forever? We won't have access to it?
No, I think you have access. So, I think hidden is the wrong way to think about it. I think it's better to think about it as potential. And can you surface all the potential of it? I think probably not in any meaningful way. But it's there so that in 50 years somebody can follow the links and see that, in fact, there's a relationship between this and that that had lain there hidden, had not been seen there before. I guess I didn't talk about this, but one of the axes... So I like the term meaning. I like the term implicit. And I like the term potential. And I'm trying to work all of those in. That the knowledge that's in there is there as potential. It's not just knowledge. It's also hunches, whims, poems. Yeah.
You say knowledge is knowledge. It doesn't matter who said it. But are there not instances where it actually matters who said it?
So what sort of thing are you thinking of?
For instance, Lawrence Summers. And they said maybe women does not make such good scientists. But if a lesser person said it, you know, it may not provoke the same reaction. That's one scenario. The second scenario, let's say, you know, the knowledge is already there. Nobody has discovered a certain way to do certain things. But if I'm the first one to say it, you know, this is how we make it, I have patented it. So it does matter who says it first, right?
So one of the things that makes this transition much easier from the old to the new, if I may, is in fact that the description that we have, our theory of knowledge, which says it has seven properties or whatever, you know, does not actually match up with how we treat knowledge. So we've never really believed, I don't think, that knowledge doesn't matter who says it, for exactly the sorts of reasons that you say. The first person to say it gets credit. A president of a university who says something that may or may not be true is being judged not only on the value of the truth value of the statement, but also the fact that he's a president of the university who said this thing. So I think you're absolutely right. But that only means that our notion of what constitutes knowledge has been formed in a way that has so little to do with human experience. So it's always been true. It's always, when Walter Cronkite said in 1960 whatever that the Vietnam War we're not winning it, mattered a huge amount that it was Walter Cronkite. It was basically why LBJ didn't run again. It was because Walter Cronkite, a news guy, the most trusted man in America, said it. Absolutely, it's always dependent on that. But that's not what our theory of knowledge says. So so that makes the transition easier, because the view of knowledge that I think we are moving to is one that's actually closer to our own experience of knowledge.
Question from the IRC channel, from Michael, saying that given that your view of our way related to knowledge is going to change, do you have any tools, computer or non-computer, that you suggest we use to advance this process? I'm giving an example in the world of law, looking at legal books and LexisNexis and sort of very traditional ways of knowledge.
No, I think this is a global generational challenge, which we're meeting quite well. That we keep evolving new ways of making connections, servicing knowledge, servicing ideas. We've been doing it at a rate that would have astounded even Da Vinci. I mean, this is, you know, and we're going to keep doing that. And most of them are not going to work, you know, just in the way of the world, most of them are not going to work. And then some of the ones that seem least likely to work, like Wikipedia, are going to turn out to work unbelievably well, incredibly well. So, I don't know what it's going to be, but somebody's going to figure it out, you know, in a million different ways.
My question is coming back to the comment when Ryan said that Google decontextualizes knowledge. It seems like a lot of these cases in which we're taking implicit knowledge and making it explicit comes in part through the metadata that we have about many people's behavior, how many people are reacting to things. So for example, in the case of the photo, it could be the computer understanding that in most cases that sort of expression indicates happiness or sadness. And so I'm just wondering if this means that long term, while right now what we're seeing on the web is that things are becoming contextualized, for example, by hyperlinking to all those things that are somewhat related. Could this sort of bring us back full circle, though, to things becoming decontextualized? Like, when we keep pushing, when the metadata and the metadata and the metadata on top of that are all what's indicating how we should make meaning of things, is that then, when you come back to this relationship of, like, the knower and the known, is that sort of just, it doesn't seem to be the same.
It's a different type of contextualization, for sure. So you take somebody posts a blog post that gets linked to 100 times, let's say, and 75 of those like it and elaborate on it, and 25 think it's the worst thing ever and argue against it. That's a different way of contextualizing that same snippet if it were in a scholarly article that is giving an argument in which it serves. It contextualizes it in 100 different ways, which still doesn't address Rebecca's need, reporting on the New York Times' need, of seeing something in a consistent, longish argument where it's developed by a single mind. I mean, there's a lot to be said for single minds who work through a problem. Something to be said for 100 different minds who are poking at it. It is absolutely a different type of contextualization, and it does not solve the decontextualization problem that Google poses to the head of the AI.
So isn't the decontextualization argument goes back to your own argument of good enough? I would think that the reason she doesn't remember if it's the New York Times or whatever, because it was good enough for her. It wasn't important enough to remember where she read it, or when it was published, or where it was published. It was only the context of the articles that she read was good enough. The same way, and I think it goes to everything, just like in life and knowledge. Even when you're talking about the surgeons and the air traffic controllers in your own example, again, I think you're not going far enough, or maybe I misunderstood, that it's good enough. There's a point where even for the surgeon for air traffic control, it's good enough, because there is another surgeon for another air traffic controller that is better, or you can always make minuscule improvements of just about anything.
Well, measurement within 1 meter is good enough for aircraft control, or whatever it is. There's some accuracy limit, and that's absolutely true in every science, Every science is based on research, and research is based on practice, and practice is based on tools. And tools have limits that are good enough, or the best we can do, and the science still proceeds. So there is a good enoughness. By the way, that argument I just gave is Bruno Latour. I don't know. There is a strong sense, which I agree with you, and in which good enough it's not a struggle between truth and good enough. It's always a struggle. It's always us deciding what's going to be good enough for us. So we stop measuring aircraft's distance at a yard because that's really all we need. That's good enough. And we stop measuring the size of a molecule and however nano whatever's because that's all we can do. So that has to be good enough. In terms of actual experience and practical work, I think there isn't that much difference between where we were and where we're going. There is, however, a difference in the metaphysics that we express. So we carry with us a metaphysics that we've built for ourselves over the 2,500 years of saying, well, no, knowledge is not... there's one knowledge. And if you start getting sloppy about it, that's necessarily wronger. There's one best answer. And we've built an economy... To some degree, we've built institutions in which people are dedicated to getting us the best answer, and everything else looks like noise. It looks like static in the line. And we're currently in an environment where I believe we're saying, you know, first of all, we can be pretty happy in most instances with a lot of static because we're getting a good enough answer. And furthermore, what looks like static for this query actually may be signal for that query. And there is no formal way of distinguishing static from noise. It's task dependent. The old metaphysics says, yeah, there is a formal way of distinguishing because the static is not true or not true enough. I'm sorry, it's a great question. It was not, I'm just sort of thinking my way through an answer. Erica, is it? You're the keeper of the... I'm not doing anything. I'm happy to, but I don't want to keep you.
Well, I think there's sort of an interesting thing that another interesting boundary to speak, which is to me, I think there's a big difference between the sort of contextualization that happens with explicit tagging and the contextualization that happens with something like Google. I think I have a pretty good understanding of how the tagging works and how all these little manual decisions build up into some answer. I have no idea how Google works beyond the very simplistic explanation that maybe was true 10 years ago but is not substantially true now. And I suspect a handful of people know how Google works. I mean, how many people really know how Google works? But yet Google is... I couldn't do my job without Google. Let alone live my, you know, I could live my life, I sort of could, you know, that seems barbaric now, but I can kind of do that. But in my job, Google is an extension of my working mind, right? I mean, I work fundamentally differently than how someone would have worked in my profession 10 years ago. My process of working is mining this method that Google has of organizing data, but I have no idea how it works, and nobody really knows how it works because it's so complicated and so emergent from that complication, and it works on implicit actions. It doesn't work by people making specific decisions to say this is the important side. It sort of works through all these sort of emergent implicit actions, and so I think there's some interesting boundary there that is changing what we're doing and is giving a lot of power, and maybe to some degree a source of a librarian's discomfort, that it's no longer that nobody's actually making a decision about what's important and what's categorized anymore, even as a crowd, even as one of a thousand. Instead, it's up to this algorithm that almost nobody understands to any significant degree, but yet determines our knowledge.
I actually would like to know how many times I consult Google in a day. I think that would be.
Scary.
Actually, that would be a good little add-in
for
Firefox.
You can
probably
use a counter.
All I heard was counter.
You can easily put a counter.
It would be a nice Firefox
extension.
I'm positive
the Google knows.
Well, in fact, there's a search history. So I went up. So I by no means dispute the importance of Google, but there are and the danger of using proprietary commercial algorithms in order to sort all the world's information, whatever Google says it's doing. Nevertheless, it is not the only thing we use to organize ideas. In fact, in some ways, we don't use it to organize ideas. We use it just simply to find ideas. We have a zillion different ways we use, and we'll have more of them, that I think will ameliorate. If all we had was Google, then it would be very scary. But we also have mailing lists and blogs and playlists and all that stuff that is not Google-based. That enables us to do different jobs of organization.
I guess, well, let me go back. I guess where my question is coming from is when you're talking about this sort of implicit versus explicit, it seemed like there's an right now when you say, well, here's a jar of jam, and here are the 10 explicit things I could come up with a tag, or here are my children, and here are that sort of 25 tags that exist with my children.
Well, that's good.
Those are sort of
do that. I'm going to tag them in the next time I show this.
those are all examples. When you're thinking about what we're doing now, those are examples of the sort of manual action of, right, it's worth 5 minutes of my time to tag my children, and it's worth 10 seconds of my time to tag this girl. But then when you start to talk about the future, I think you start thinking about these implicit methods. You start thinking about running algorithms. You start thinking about, well, I can cure it if I've got a camera. Most of us have digital cameras and take lots of pictures. If that increase in order of magnitude, or if there are cameras on me all the time anyway, and that's getting stored, the assumption that is that to really mine that, to really sort of grow the amount of explicit information that's out there, that it's not going to be sitting on writing tags. It's going to be some sort of image recognition. So it would be pretty
and
easy.
Connection to your calendar and to GPS. And
right. And so, simple things like face recognition, that's not that difficult to do. And, even now you could carry a camera that would figure out, that would record everyone you've met ever or moved or things like that. You start to think about these automatic methods that are not simply sitting down and writing. And it's not that they're necessarily proprietary. That's sort of the whole thing. If Google was open source, we still wouldn't understand, right? The problem is just sort of creating these enormously complex algorithms that have these very difficult to understand emergent results, and then sort of plugging those in cyborg-like into our brains and relying on them to create the knowledge that we use in our lives.
I wonder if early on in the history of libraries and recording knowledge and early science, people had similar objections to books and tables of results of experiments. I don't know, but I could imagine making a similar sort of argument. Well, how do I know that when I combine these two chemicals, I get this other chemical unless I do it myself? Why would I want to trust this complex periodic table of the elements or something like that?
And not just that, but if you think like 50 years ago, 100 years ago, discussing Google or Googling, you would have the same thing. Why would you trust what Google found for you, for that matter?
But this come back to, are you driving at that in that case, the implicit doesn't become explicit?
I'm sort of capturing this notion that knowledge is sort of making the implicit explicit, and that's the sort of process of knowledge creation. And I guess my point is we're increasingly not in control of that, and it's not so much an issue of authority for me. You can decide whether you trust Google or not. And there's sort of other issues of, the librarian likes to be in charge, and that's why he doesn't like Google, because he doesn't get to say what's good. But I think there's a deeper point that Google and other technologies like it are so complex that they are unknowable for the vast majority of people who understand them. For people who use them, rather.
But so is the creation of you know, power, like the creation of electricity.
But that's not directly plugged into knowledge creation, right? It's not. I mean, there's a difference between just using something, driving a car. Driving a car is not as much a definition of who I am, right?
As using Google?
Yes, because Google is directly plugged into my sort of knowledge creation. It's,
or meaning.
It determines my conception of the world, you know, like a car.
As doesn't. Well, the creation as well, because it's as much as you can get around and see and get to.
Yes, sir.
But can you not combine a few search engines which can do a better job than Google? It only takes a bit longer. It's like every day you take a bus, you know, say to Boston, and suddenly you can't live without a bus. Actually, you can walk and you can take a taxi, but you haven't discovered yet. But maybe somebody will come up with a gargle who can do better than Google. So maybe at this stage you are using Google too much, but actually there could be other ways where you can search for better information through a combination of search engines.
Right, but I think in order to be as good or better than Google, it's going to have to be as complex and as emergent as Google is, right? So again, it's not so much an issue of authority or a single source as it is an issue of the nature of the sort of wisdom of the crowds, but it's a wisdom of a crowd that is not even a sort of a crowd doing anything, it's just a crowd living their
life. Before Google, what search engine do you use?
Excite, AltaVista.
OpenText? Sorry.
Hotwire.
Right, but those search engines were so ineffective that they weren't integrated into our workflow.
Right, exactly. I mean, I didn't use AltaVista. Well, it's tough to know because, you know, there was so much less content there anyway.
Right.
The mode, from what I remember, the mode of using AltaVista was more like, oh shit, I can't find it, I guess I better go wait through, you know, AltaVista. As opposed to Google's, like, you know, I don't know something. It's like, you know, step two and figure out.
But I don't think it has to do with how complex Google is. I don't think Google is any more or less complex than AltaVista was.
It is.
Infinitely more. AltaVista is not emergent. AltaVista is just counting
not
the number
anymore.
Of words.
I think that the strength of Google was its simplicity and so on. It created a huge market of people up to use it. So the market of what was there and available, what people were making available, because there were so many people were searching. It's sort of one hand was washing another constantly and going back and forth.
Right, sure. And if AltaVista...
But the algorithm still remains complex. That might be how Google succeeded, but I think the algorithm, which is... If I understand what you're saying, it's like if the general trend of the internet is to make the implicit explicit, and yet if so much of the knowledge is being captured in the internet, is this sort of metadata that we make use of and yet is not explicitly understood by us, then how much is this greater trend something that improves my knowledge as opposed to the whole internet? And out of that whole, is the wisdom of the crowd beyond me? I never understand.
Why don't you just join the crowd?
Yeah.
I actually intended to say something, say the opposite of that, which is that the work of the internet is to make more and more implicit, thus to increase the potential for knowledge and understanding over the course of time. But that's what I meant to say, and I can see why I didn't say that.
Does this sound like a good place to rethink for now? People want to continue an informal discussion. That's totally fine, but otherwise, thank you.
Thank you.